Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Will Fain, U.S. Marshal, by R.O. Lane. Narrated by A.T. Chandler. Chapter 1.
"You may go in now, Colonel Fain," the President's aide said.
As Will Fain entered the office, President Ulysses S. Grant arose and moved from behind his desk.
"How are you, Colonel?"
"Quite well, General," he said, as he shook Grant's hand. To Will, he would always be the General, a much higher rank in his estimation than President, and Grant never seemed to object to being called General. It was a sign of comradeship, a loyalty shared between military officers that nobody else would ever know. They had fought together and won together. Loyalty to the uniform was what these men felt. And very few knew of the extraordinary loyalty Grant felt for those with whom he'd served.
"Sit down, sit down. Let's have a drink before we talk. What's your pleasure, Colonel?"
"I think you know well enough, General. Old Crow, straight up." Grant chuckled joyously.
"A man after my own heart. I'll have the same," President Grant said as he poured the drinks. "Here's to your health, Will," he said, handing Will his drink and taking a large swallow of his own. "Oh my, that's good. My first of the day."
Grant sat down and over his glass he gave his former aide a careful appraisal, then asked,
"What's this I hear about you leaving the Secret Service, Will?"
"General, I don't know what the word is, really. Restless, I guess. I want to do something else with my life, and for some unknown reason I see my future out west. I don't really understand the motivation myself."
"But you're from Tennessee."
"Used to be," Will laughed.
"Not much there now for me, General. The homestead is gone, all but the land. Ma and Pa are gone, 3 of my brothers died fighting in the war, all Tennessee volunteers. My youngest brother, Cole by name, farms down in Alabama near his wife's family. He's all the family I've got left, and the war stands between us. Most likely always will. He resents me, and you, and every Yankee everywhere. There's a lot of hate down there. I don't want to go back to Tennessee where any family I might have would be resented. They consider me a traitor, and I don't blame them. I don't know how we can overcome it, Will. Those rebels who fought at Vicksburg will teach their children to hate us Yanks, and me in particular, for generations to come. And for you, I can't even imagine. I'm sure it's quite painful to lose so much as a result of the war, especially since you fought for us and your brothers fought for the South. War was hell for all of us." The President looked off at a wall of books, lost in contemplation for a few seconds, then came back to the subject at hand. "Will, we've been together since Shiloh. You were the best aide I ever had on military strategy, and you've been an outstanding Secret Service officer. I determined that by the fact that I'm still alive, unlike poor Abe Lincoln."
Grant laughed heartily, then asked,
"Do you know the day Lincoln signed the bill creating the Secret Service?"
Will knew all right, but he didn't want to spoil Grant's fun.
"Tell me, General."
"The afternoon of the day he was killed," Grant said.
"Ironic as hell, isn't it?"
"Yes. He'd won the war, and then to die at the hands of a ne'er-do-well like Booth just leaves a bad taste in your mouth," Will said.
"Yeah, it does. Now tell me, what are you going to do out west, besides get shot up by Comanches and sweat to death?"
"Good question. I don't have a good answer. Thought I might try ranching. I've saved a little money. Maybe I'll try raising some horses.
You know I left the Army after the Mexican War. I was out of the Army for 7 years. I farmed a little, clerked in a store for a while. I wasn't very good at it, and I was poor as a church mouse. It was nice being home with my family, but when the war started, I couldn't wait to sign up. Got back in as a colonel. I hated many things about the war and loved others, but after Lincoln named me commander-in-chief, I was charged with saving the Union, and I was determined to do it. When I was at the military academy, I never dreamed of being commander-in-chief. I was a Midland student, but I learned on the job. The war changed me in lots of ways. Maybe that's why I drink so much of this old crow, Grant said, gazing down at the amber liquid in his glass. I know you hate what the war did to your family, Will, but I don't see you setting a horse watching your cattle chew cuds. You're not built for it. You might be right. And maybe that's why I'm resigning the service. I mean, there will always be counterfeiters, and the Secret Service will do a good job at catching them. And it's been a privilege, sir, serving with you in the war and keeping you safe as president. Maybe at this point I just need to do something different. Something that challenges me, maybe. I hate to lose you, Will, but I've got an idea that might interest you. Grant paused and finished his drink. How would you feel about being a U.S. Marshal? In Texas? It would make me a hell of a target. Seems like they got more outlaws than cattle down there. There's murders, rapes, bank robberies, train robberies, you name it. Not to mention all the Indian trouble, and then there's all that resentment about the war. I hear the Confederacy lives on in a large part of Texas. Grant laughed. You're right, my boy. But there's a lot of good people out there and more arriving all the time. That's why we need men like you to set things straight. There are more and more good, solid settlers. For their sake, we've got to subdue the Indians. I've put Sherman in charge of that, and he's got some good officers carrying the fight. You know Ranald McKenzie, Will. He's in charge of the 4th Cavalry. He's one of the finest young officers in the Army. If anyone can subdue the Comanches, he's the man. He's already been wounded 4 or 5 times in battle. During the war, he lost 2 fingers on his right hand, and some of the junior officers call him Bad Hand. Behind his back, of course, Grant chuckled. Sherman will get the job done eventually. We're encouraging the buffalo hunters. Our official policy is to let them kill off the buffalo herds. It'll take a while, but eventually all the buffalo will be gone, and that's going to put more and more pressure on the tribes to surrender and go onto the reservations. Will thought Sherman was the right man, all right. He was the most vicious commander Will had ever known, and Will didn't agree with Sherman's war strategy in the South. The very idea of killing women and children and allowing his soldiers to pillage, rape, and murder Southern civilians was something Will could never accept. Southerners had a right to hate Sherman, and by extension, Grant, who permitted Sherman's war crimes. But Will had served the cause he embraced while not always agreeing with the tactics employed. Grant sat forward in his chair. You know, Will, the war changed all of us. Some more than others. A lot of the Rebs we sent home, thankfully most, will return to farming and other pursuits and will peaceably carry on with their lives. But for others, the war removed any fear or reluctance they ever had of killing another human being. And in the South, and that includes Texas, there's so much resentment about losing the war. And some who fought have continued to murder and steal and plunder. These men have to be brought to justice, dead or alive. Will could not mistake the earnestness in Grant's tone. All those Rebs who want to continue to be outlaws, we have to kill them or imprison them. Look, Will, if you'll accept this, I'll appoint you a United States Marshal, not a deputy, a full United States Marshal with authority wherever you step in this country. I've tried to get Congress to pass a law giving our marshals a salary, but they haven't done that yet. The marshals get their money from serving process from their court, and the marshals have to pay their deputies. It's wrong, but it's the way it's been for nearly a century. We'll get it changed one of these days. Actually, I thought about naming you a U.S. District Judge. You handled a lot of courts martial during the war. You know the law better than most of our judges, Grant said. But you'd wither and die on the vine sitting behind a desk every day. If you accept the post of U.S. Marshal, here's what I'll do. I'll keep you on the payroll as long as I'm president as a detached Secret Service officer. You'll continue to be paid every month. At the same time, I'll appoint you a U.S. Marshal at large in perpetuity. No district judge or anyone else can fire you. You'll be relieved of your badge only when you resign. Wherever you go, you can work with the district judge. Will you do it, Will? General, I know you're the president, but how can you do that? I mean, keep me on the payroll when I won't even be here, Will asked. Grant laughed loudly. Don't you worry about it. I can do it. In addition to being president, I'm a war hero. Who is going to tell me I can't? We appoint judges for life, why not a U.S. Marshal? Will was well aware of all the scandals surrounding the Grant administration. The president had appointed over 40 of his relatives to various government posts, and he was constantly hounded for the misdeeds of others in his administration. But for Will, the general would always be esteemed. And at this point, Grant had the same old magic about him, that power to bring others to his viewpoint. Will thought, how can I say no? How can I turn down this man whom I served so long? I can't say no, General, Will told Grant. But I'm going to need some good equipment. I'm going to need some horses, fast horses. Then I'm going to need the best weapons I can get. I don't want to come up against these outlaws without having everything I need to win. Grant smiled and rubbed his hands, knowing he'd won another campaign. I can help you with the horses and the arms. I'll put you in touch with the right people, and I'll figure out a way to take care of the costs. Don't you worry. We'll get you ready for this campaign. Grant paused, gave Will a most serious look, then said, Of course, Colonel, you realize this is a campaign we can never totally win. There will always be outlaws, but our mission, your mission, is to tamp them down hard so that life is tolerable for decent people. And one other thing, Will. If you ever run up against anything out there, anyone out there that hinders you in doing your job, send me a telegram, and I'll do what I can for you. Chapter 2 The following morning, Will arose with his mind awhirl at the preparations that lay ahead. He dressed for the day. He was just buttoning his vest when he heard a knock at his apartment door. Opening the door, he was greeted by a tall man dressed elegantly who said, My name is Atticus Webb. I'm with the War Department. The President asked me to assist you, Mr. Fain. He informed me it's quite urgent. Yes, won't you come in? Webb responded. Well, actually, I'm ready to take you to Dunstan Farm, where we can arrange for the purchase of horses, and we need to hurry if we're going to make our train. Let me get my bowler, and we can be on our way, Fain said. The two men walked quickly, with Webb setting a furious pace. How far is Dunstan Farm, and where is it? Oh, sorry, I guess I should have mentioned. It's just outside Philadelphia. We can catch the train in... Webb hesitated as he consulted his pocket watch. In exactly 16 minutes. We'll be there before noon. They just managed to catch the Baltimore and Potomac train at the National Mall. Somehow, Fain felt like this whole adventure was nothing more than a pipe dream. When the rented carriage passed under a large metal arch into Dunstan Farms, Fain found it was anything but a pipe dream. To his right, he saw a racetrack with several horses being exercised. At the end of the long lane, there were stables for at least 40 horses, as well as several barns. To his left, beyond a large pasture, lay a large white federal-style home, 2 stories with wine-colored shutters. The grounds around the home were immaculate. Beyond the main house were several smaller homes. Fain guessed they were for the trainers, grooms, jockeys, and stable hands. Behind the barn and around the racetrack were large pastures with the most beautiful horses Fain had ever seen. Chestnuts, bays, sorrels, duns, blacks. It was a horseman's paradise, and Fain found himself enthralled. The carriage pulled up in front of the stable where grooms were currying 2 horses. A large man was rapidly approaching the carriage. Webb jumped out of the carriage, followed by Fain. Ah, Lamar Dunstan, good to see you. Let me introduce Will Fain. Will shook Dunstan's hand. It's a pleasure to be here amongst the most beautiful horses I've ever seen. Dunstan gave Will a wide smile. Good of you to say so. We race some, we board some, we breed the very best. And we have some for sale, which is what you're interested in, eh?
Will nodded appreciatively.
Yes, indeed. The telegram I received yesterday indicated you wanted horses to use in your duties as a U.S. Marshal. We have several that I can show you. They're solid, have great lines, and come from good stock.
Are they fast? Will asked.
Dunstan laughed. Oh, yes, they're fast. But maybe not quite fast enough to win the Travers, but they'll beat any other horse you can name. How many do you need?
Will glanced at Webb, unsure if Grant had put any restrictions on him. He thought, I should just go for broke. On the other hand, I don't want the general to think I'm presuming upon his generosity. He turned to Dunstan.
I'd like six. Three stallions, three fillies, or young mares.
Dunstan said,
I've brought in several from the paddock so that you can have a look. Let's go to the stables.
Dunstan took off at a rapid clip with Will and Webb in pursuit. Dunstan stopped outside a stall and said,
This is Traveler. He's 4 years old, what we call a black chestnut. He's not the most gentle horse, but then stallions usually aren't. But for a stallion, he's pretty gentle. His sire is Ruthless, winner of the Travers some years back. If you're looking for a horse that will outrun trouble, this is him. He works on the track 5 days a week. There's not many here that can outrun him. Don't get me wrong, there might be one or two, but he's fast.
Will reached his hand and scratched behind Traveler's ear. Traveler placed his muzzle on Will's chest, then threw his head back and shoved Will back. Dunstan said,
You see what I mean? You think he's enjoying all your attention, and he rears back to let you know he doesn't need you to pet him. Still, he's a jewel of a horse.
He was a beautiful horse. Nobody could deny it. He was so dark he was almost black, with a small blaze on his face and three small white stockings. Will said,
He's a beauty. He and I are going to get along just fine. How tall is he?
Little over 16 hands, taller than the average for the stallions, Dunstan replied.
Let's get him saddled so that you can ride him. You can test his speed for yourself.
On the track, Will leaned over, patted Traveler's neck, and said,
Let's see what you can do, big boy.
He eased up on the reins, gave the horse his head, and kicked him lightly in the ribs. Never had Will sat such a horse. It was glorious, almost like flying, a freedom unknown in any other way. Will was one with the horse, feeling as if it had wings. Traveler was the finest horse he had ever known, and he'd ridden some good ones in the army. But nothing could compare to this awesome stallion. At the mile pole, Will eased back on the reins and Traveler slowed.
Good boy, good boy, you did great. You're everything anyone could ever want in a horse.
Traveler gave a short blow and bobbed his head as if in agreement. By mid-afternoon, Will had selected Traveler and five other thoroughbreds. Will asked Dunstan to have them ready in a week.
I'll be taking them on a long trip, Will said, and I'll be traveling with them every mile to make sure they travel well and have everything they need in water and food.
Dunstan agreed, then said,
You're going to need 40 to 50 gallons of water a day for 6 horses and lots of hay and grain. If you get a chance, you'll want to take them all off the train at intermediate points on the journey and let them spend some time in the paddock. I'm afraid where I'm going they don't have paddocks. But they do have corrals and pastures.
Will laughed.
Don't worry about your horses, Mr. Dunstan. I'll see they get some exercise along the way.
They'll be well cared for, have no fear.
Will replied. Chapter 3 Leaving Dunstan Farms, Webb said to Will, Tomorrow we'll visit the Winchester plant in New Haven and the following day Colt's factory in Hartford. President Grant, as you probably know, has friends in both of these companies. They're going to assure that you have the very best weaponry possible. Since we'll be visiting 2 factories and you'll need time in each to shoot and evaluate the weapons, we probably should plan to stay at least 2 or 3 days. Both companies will want to entertain us in hopes that we'll speak well of them to the president so that they'll get more government contracts. Little do they know how little influence we have. Webb snorted.
Let's not dissuade them from thinking we have at least a little influence. Will laughed. It was hard for Will to believe he was really preparing to be a U.S. Marshal, that his life was going to change so drastically. But he enjoyed the fresh sense of direction, the planning and preparation almost as if it were a military campaign. He thought about Traveler and the other horses. Owning such horses had only been a dream, and now it was real, something he could touch and feel. The horses were the most beautiful he'd ever seen. He was beginning the rest of his life, and it was exciting. Upon their arrival in New Haven, Webb excused himself, saying he had other business, though Will suspected Webb wanted Will to have the Winchester experience to himself. When Will's carriage arrived at the Winchester Repeating Arms plant in New Haven, Connecticut, he was surprised at the size of the place. Its giant red brick building covered at least 2 acres. Will entered the factory and was greeted by Plant Superintendent Nelson King. Will was pleased to meet this man. He knew King had designed the new type of loading gate that made the Yellow Boy so popular. The gate passed cartridges through the side of the receiver, the major factor in the popularity of the Yellow Boy. After the introductions were over, King offered a tour of the factory. During the tour, Will was most fascinated as they strolled the milling floor where rifle components were being made. Dozens of machinists in their blue denim shop aprons were fabricating components for their rifles that everyone was calling the finest in the world. The organization of the factory was a miracle to Will. "Mr. King, I couldn't be more impressed. Your factory efficiency is second to none. How many different parts are you making on the floor?"
"Probably around 60 or 70 right now," King replied. "The Yellow Boy itself has more than 50 components." Then King said, "Excuse me for a minute."
He walked over and consulted briefly with one of the foremen, apparently resolving an issue in the machining process. Upon returning, he asked Will,
"You ready to see some finished rifles?"
Will smiled and said, "That's why I'm here, Mr. King." Will followed King into a room filled with every model Winchester had ever produced and lots of other weaponry as well. It was like a museum. Displayed were the internal workings of every rifle. Will recognized the Henrys and Yellow Boys, the Spencers and the Sharps. He'd seen plenty of the Henrys during the war, and shortly after the war ended, he had personally bought himself a Yellow Boy for $22. It was the finest rifle he'd ever shot. The lever mechanism was so smooth it was a pleasure to use a rifle that functioned so perfectly. And the mechanism had never failed. The Henrys sometimes jammed, but his Yellow Boy never had. Will gave a casual look at the older rifles. Then he spied some rifles on a table in a corner of the room.
"What are these?" Will asked. "Prototypes that we hope to introduce next year," King said. "Much more powerful than the Yellow Boy. The action is very similar, except many of the components are made of iron and steel, which makes it more durable, and we believe it's more accurate as well. It's chambered for a .44 caliber with 40 grains of powder. The centerfire cartridge offers much greater stopping power." "But enough talk," King said. "Let's get you on the shooting range. I'd appreciate your opinion about our new prototypes that we're calling the Winchester 73.
After shooting the prototype rifles, Will said,
"I didn't think any rifle would be better than my Yellow Boy, but this is superior. I believe it may be a little more accurate. And you can feel the extra power," Will said, before adding, "Too bad they're only in prototype." "After getting the telegram about you from the White House, I sent a copy to Mr. Winchester, who is in San Francisco at the moment," King said. "He said to give you whatever you needed, so I have my orders. If you need a few of these prototypes, you'll get them. Without any engravings or other special requirements, we can have them ready in 4 days.
Will asked for 5 rifles, 2 with 28-inch barrels and 3 with 24-inch barrels. He was elated when King agreed. He thanked him profusely and made arrangements to have the rifles sent to his address in the nation's capital. He then hailed a carriage, and once back at the hotel, made plans with Webb to visit Colt's factory in Hartford the next day.
Chapter 4 The train took an hour to get from New Haven to Hartford. Once again, Webb excused himself, and Will was left alone to conduct his business at Colt's factory, which seemed larger than the Winchester factory, though similar in its all-brick style with lots of windows for the best possible lighting. He was greeted by a tall man who looked like a professor with rimless spectacles on his nose, wild hair, and a bushy mustache.
"I'm Charles Richards, Mr. Fane, Superintendent of Engineering for Colt's. We received a telegram from the White House asking that we assist you in every possible way, and we're prepared to do that. How can we help?"
"Mr. Richards, I appreciate your willingness to help. The President has named me a United States Marshal, and I'm headed to West Texas. I'm going to run up against some of the worst outlaws in the country, and I need some weapons to help me stay alive."
"You've come to the right place, Mr. Fane. First, though, I'd like to show you our factory," Richards said. "I think you'll be very impressed."
And Will certainly appreciated the organization and thought that went into the manufacturing process. From forging to the extremely complicated finishing required to put together the finest pistols in the world, Will knew he'd come to the right place, and also that Colt had more government contracts at the moment than Winchester. Richards said,
"I've got one more section of the factory I'd like you to see."
He led Will through a long hallway. Richards opened the door, and they walked into a dedicated factory for Gatling guns. Several already assembled Gatling guns were standing like soldiers at attention against one wall.
"We're supplying the Army and Navy with Gatling guns," Richards said. "And we have orders from several governments in Europe and even South America. It's an incredible weapon that gives our army, with just a few men, the ability to fight off much larger forces."
"I'm familiar with it," Will said. "I've seen what type of damage it can inflict. Of course, they do have their disadvantages."
Richards' face showed his surprise.
"I don't have any military expertise, but not many disadvantages come immediately to mind."
Will didn't want to be rude, so he said,
"They're terrific for close-order fighting. Nothing better. But let's suppose I'm on a hill 400 yards away with cannon and mortar. Your Gatling gun can't reach me to take me out, and I can bombard you all day long. If I'm using grape or canister, it will give me almost the same effect as a Gatling gun."
Richards nodded appreciatively.
"I see what you mean. I'm afraid I'm not up on my battle tactics, and it's obvious you are.
Nevertheless, it would be interesting to have one on the frontier," Will mused. "In the right place at the right time, you could inflict incredible damage. I wish I could take one with me to Texas."
"Interesting idea," Richards said. "How would you use it if you had one?"
"I'm not sure. But many of these outlaws travel in gangs," Will related. "They rob banks and trains in gangs, and sometimes they have so much firepower that lawmen suffer in these encounters. If we had one of these, it could make a difference if we could get it in position at the right moment. But it's probably impractical."
"It's an interesting concept," Richards said. "And we're delivering them to the Army for its campaign against the Indians. Perhaps, if necessary, you could borrow one from the Army."
Will had his doubts about that, but said nothing.
"That ends the tour," Richards said as he turned to leave. "Come with me. We're going to outfit you completely with everything you'll need."
Richards took Will to a magnificent firing range and said,
"Try this holster, and we'll get you a Colt 44-40.
Richards left and returned with another man.
"Mr. Fane, this is Charlie Bissell. He's an expert shootist. He can draw and shoot as fast as anyone alive. We brought him up from New York to help with your instruction."
Will shook hands with Bissell, and Richards handed Will a new Colt, which he put into the holster.
"What I want you to do is draw and shoot," Bissell said. "Draw and shoot like you normally would. I'll watch and assess where you are and what kind of weapons you need."
Will's father had taught all his sons to shoot at an early age. When Will was 12, his father had let him strap on a Colt Patterson, and Will had learned to draw and fire it with ease. His uncle Con had taught him to draw it fast and never aim, just point it like his finger and pull the trigger. Will had proved quite adept.
Uncle Con had said to him one day, "Will, I've never seen anyone with quicker hands than you. It's a God-given gift, boy. Don't you ever..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?